Good evening. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. Representative Breinert moves approval of the minutes dated March 3rd. Are there any corrections, changes, additions, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we have one item on our agenda tonight. This is an overview of the compensatory funding formula by nonpartisan staff. In addition, after the completion of nonpartisan staff's presentation, we'll be opening up the floor for public testimony. So at this time, we will call on our legislative superheroes, Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom, to provide an overview of compensatory. Periodically through the presentation, if you have any questions, we'll provide for appropriate breaks at the times to allow for a discussion. So that'll be that. So Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair and members, you have some handouts in your packet, and there's a couple of district-by-district printouts that are being generated that we'll refer to when they get back from duplicating. We're going to talk a little bit about compensatory revenue, how it's calculated, what it's for, and how it's spent. And just in general, compensatory revenue in its current form was created back in 1997. Is based on the number of free and reduced lunch price students at a school site and the concentration of those students at a school site. It is one of the few formulas that we have that is calculated on a site basis, and the money that is generated by the formula follows the student to whatever site they're being served at. The expenditures free and reduced price lunch is used as a proxy for at-risk students in generating revenue, but the money that's spent while being used on at-risk students isn't necessarily spent on the students that generate the funding. Obviously, every student who qualifies for free or reduced price lunch is not an at-risk student, and every at-risk student doesn't necessarily qualify for free and reduced price lunch. And so under 126C15, there's a list of revenue uses that compensatory can be used on, and it ranges from remedial instruction to assurance of mastery, instructional services, additional teachers, teachers' aides, longer school days, staff development, programs for reduced truancy, and all-day kindergarten, extended school day, increasing parent involvement. So there's a broad range of things that the money can be spent on. As I said, it doesn't have to, while it travels with the student, it doesn't necessarily get spent directly on that student. For example, a site may have a dozen students that qualify for free and reduced price lunch. The money that is generated by those students might be used on a reading program that serves two or three sections, 60 or 90 students, and provides some sort of instruction to those students to help them with whatever it is that's triggering that at-risk designation. So that's the program in general. We've included a couple of one-page sheets that you might find useful. There's this short table, which goes back 20 years or so and shows how compensatory revenue has changed over time. You can see in 1996 the revenue totaled about $128 million. And for fiscal 2015, projecting almost $500 million of compensatory revenue. You can also see how the percent of students eligible for free and reduced price lunches has changed between 1999 and fiscal 2012. And you can see it's gone up by almost half, from 26% to 36% of all students. So that's been one thing that's driven the increase in funding for compensatory revenue. The other thing is that the compensatory revenue formula, and we'll talk about how it's calculated in a second, keys off the basic formula allowance. Right now, it keys off of the basic formula allowance minus $415. But over that time, as the formula allowance has grown, compensatory funding has increased as well. You can see, I think it was 03, Yeah, you can see between 03 and 04 there's a slight decline, and that's when that $415 subtraction was implemented. And that $415 subtraction has to do with a technical roll-in of the basic formula amount. And so that roll-in is then subtracted in subsequent years. So there was a big jump between 02 and 03 when that $415 was rolled into the basic formula. And then the legislature reconsidered and backed the $415 out of the formula for purposes of calculating compensatory revenue. It's a fairly not straightforward calculation of compensatory. So
Not straightforward. Really, can you just elaborate on that, Mr. Crow? What do you mean by not straightforward? Something other than straightforward?
If you still have your books, I'm sorry, the wrong page. I must have sent the wrong page to the committee. If you have your brown book and
no,
you look on page 14, do you not have it? Okay. We'll make a couple copies, or if we have some more on the cart, maybe we can share those with Representative Greiling and Representative Mariani.
You can copy mine. That's fine. Yeah, did she?
14.
Thank you.
Carla.
Carla.
That's pretty straightforward. Basically, the way in general the compensatory is calculated is that looks like everyone's got one or has one nearby, is that the number of free students eligible for free lunch is counted as one, and the number of students eligible for reduced price lunches is counted as a half. And the simplest formula would take that 1.5 and multiply it by the basic formula, but this has been tweaked a little bit as it was created. And so one of the factors that's included is a concentration factor. And you can see on page 14 that the concentration factor is that first calculation with the big 100 times 100 plus 200 over 2 over 800 over 80. Really, what that does, what that lump of fraction does, is it divides, it calculates the concentration. So the 100 free lunch students plus 200 reduced price lunch students is the top line. So that counts as 200 total students, then divided by the 800 students in the district in this example, you would get a 25% concentration. But that's too simple. So instead of just having a 20... No, I have to...
Oh, the staff get feisty after 6 o'clock, don't they? Offering some editorials on the legislature, huh? What happens at midnight?
Oh, you'll find out.
Mr. Crow.
Maybe today, maybe later in the session.
Well, if we find out tonight, we've got other problems. So proceed with your thoughtful and analytical testimony, Mr. Crow.
So, please. Mr. Chair and members, first thing that's done is to calculate that concentration at 25%. But then the formula actually caps the amount of concentration that matters for calculating the revenue at 80%. So if you think of a scale of 1 to 100, it's actually, or 0 to 100, the scale is actually 0 to 80, with 80 being 100. So if you're at 80%, for purposes of calculating this formula, you're at 100% concentration, or maximum concentration amount. And so that's what all that does, is it takes your actual concentration and scales it against that 80%. And then for reasons really none other than hitting a target when it was created, we multiply that times 60%. So sometimes when the legislature creates formulas, they start as, you know, policy and kind of end up getting tweaked to hit reality. And so there's a, you see that 0.6 right in the middle of the formula. We take basically either 60% of the concentration or 60% of the pupils and count those for calculating the number of compensatory pupils. And so if you follow that calculation through, you see that the compensation pupil units is 120, which is 100 plus 200 over 2 times 0.6. So the 200 pupils using our 1 plus 1 plus a half times 0.6 equals 120. So that's sort of the prorated pupil count times the 25% over 80, which is 0.313. So in this case, the concentration for purposes of compensatory, the 25% concentration equals about 31.3%. So that 31.3% is multiplied by that kind of modified pupil count of 120 to get 37.6 pupil units. And that's the pupil count we use for compensatory revenue, and we multiply that against the formula minus 415, and you can see that calculation of maximum compensatory revenue of $177,000. So in this example, there's sort of a concentrated school, and then at the bottom half of the page, there's a less concentrated school, 10 free lunch students, 20 reduced price lunch students, a concentration of 10%, and that works out to 12.5%. On the 10 over 80 or 80% scale. So those 12 students times 12.5% means in a non-concentrated school like this, you only have 1.5 pupil units, and it generates $7,000 for the school. So to kind of get an idea of what that means for revenue, I put this chart in your packet. And what this chart does is it shows how depending on your concentration, the revenue changes on a per compensatory pupil basis. And so you can see from 0% concentration up to 80%, that the amount of revenue grows on a linear basis until it hits 2,825, which is the maximum amount of revenue that a compensatory pupil unit can generate. And then at 80%, that line gets flat, and any amount above 80% of concentration generates the same amount per pupil unit. This number is not comparable to the number you see on most of the printouts we give you, because those printouts generally show the total revenue at a school district, and then divide that revenue by the number of students in the school district. This is a calculation per compensatory pupil unit. So, for example, if the district was composed entirely of pupils that qualified, then you'd see a number like this. But a district that's maybe 10% qualifying would show a number of more like $280 per pupil on kind of our normal printout of what we show you when we talk about revenue. We've got some printouts coming. Is there anything you want to add while we're what? We kill some time?
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Chair,
to get us to midnight?
That's right. A couple of comments about the historical nature of the formula that may provide some context for why things are as goofy as they are. And one of those is, prior to 1996, our calculation was based on the number of children from families that qualified for AFDC. And that count was actually taken by the county, not by the school district. So the school districts would get a count reported to them from the Department of Education that was generated by the county. And there had been a great deal of discussion in the 80s and early 90s about whether free and reduced lunch would be a better count, or whether AFDC would be a better count, or whether some census numbers would be a better count. A study out of the University of Wisconsin in Madison looked at a whole variety of factors and a bunch of data, and basically came to the conclusion that the AFDC count was a better proxy variable for the relative needs of the students than either census information on income or free and reduced lunch counts. Interestingly enough, though, what changed the formula was the federal government's elimination as AFDC. And so when that happened in 1996, the state both needed to change its basis for calculation and essentially approximate something that provided the same distribution as the AFDC formula. And that's part of why the formula amounts had the 0.6 in them and the 0.80, the 80% in them, was that that design of the formula essentially more closely approximated the AFDC distribution than some others. And in fact, one other point to make about that is the AFDC count was added to the pupil count and was something referred to as total pupil units. So the compensatory count prior to our change to free and reduced lunch actually played through all of the formulas. It was like an additional pupil weighting. So part of the issue then became how to match the existing formula, but also then what relative value, since we now had two variables, we had free and reduced price lunch, how to relatively weight those. And there wasn't really any data on that at the time. The free lunch count, as members are aware, is set at about 130% of income adjusted for family size, and the reduced price eligibility is 185% of income. So those two amounts were available, and there was some thought that free lunch students perhaps were a better proxy for those in need of additional assistance, so should be weighted more. But there wasn't anything magical about the 1 and the 0.5. As you might guess, the 0.5 was just simply half of 1 and was chosen with some thought in mind that we're matching a previous distribution, and secondly, that we've got a number that's probably got less of an impact in terms of need than the free lunch count. Relatively speaking, over time, the reduced lunch concentration compared to the free lunch has been about, or pupil counts have been about the same, with the reduced lunch running at about a quarter of the free lunch number of students. So that history may be a little helpful for you in terms of understanding why a formula has so many twists and turns in it, because essentially at that time, one of the goals of that formula, the goals of the legislature, was to not alter the distribution substantially from our former measure, which was the AFDC count. A couple other historical factors that may be helpful to talk about. One of the other great big changes that happened when we went away from the AFDC count was that we had much more flexibility as to whether the formula could be calculated on a site level or a district level. And this was important because the AFDC count, as I mentioned, was simply given by the county. County Human Service workers would report that number to the Department of Education, and there was no building level data associated with that. And in fact, there was some concern that maybe the counties weren't necessarily even getting the kids exactly in the right school districts with that measure as well. But when the count changed to the free and reduced lunch count, it then became possible for the legislature to consider doing the concentration at each school site. And part of that was a factor at the time that there was an emphasis on going more towards site-based funding, and this was one way to deliver resources to a particular site so that they would be tracked at that site. It also, however, as we determined in the few years after the formula was implemented, raised a second question, which was it became apparent that distribution of a formula with a concentration like this is different on a site level than on a district level. If you take our same data for compensatory and run it at the district level compared to the site level, you spend less money statewide and you iron out some of the highs and lows, because concentrated sites, because of the concentration formulas, receive relatively more money per pupil than if a larger site is if two buildings are combined into a larger site. So in other words, a small site with little concentration and another small site with high concentration generates more money than if those two sites were combined into one site. Now this is important for a couple of reasons. One, it's a distributional issue that the legislature needs to think about whether it should still be a site-based formula, but it's also important, I think, in that it gets to the heart of how concentration works and what can lead or not lead to those concentration numbers. So, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add that history for you as to why we went where we did with the formula when we went from AFDC to the free and reduced lunch counts.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Representative Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions for staff. Thank you. I'm surprised looking at the graph here that we've got this plateau. So after about 80% of poverty, free and reduced lunch count in a school, there is no additional funding provided for higher poverty student populations. Is that
I would, representative, I assume you mean from the state. You're not including federal sources. You mean just state sources?
Compensatory education revenue.
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, yeah, if you look at the example there, I kind of glossed over it, but there the calculation of concentration is the lesser of one or that concentration percentage divided by 80. So when you hit 80, and when you go above 80, that calculation results in a concentration greater than one, which in statute then you're limited to concentration of one on that 0 to 80 scale. So yeah, as soon as you hit 80, anything above that, if that greater than or lesser than one or the result wasn't there, that line would keep going up, but that one and that percent over 80 calculation is what limits that the formula and kind of creates that plateau at the top for 80% and higher.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question for Mr. Strom based on the presentation he was doing. What do we know about childhood poverty in Minnesota over the last decade? Declining, increasing, decreasing, plateau. What are our schools seeing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney is reading ahead again. If you look at the printout that's oriented landscape style on the page, we'll get to that in just a few minutes. We've got about 10 years of history right here, and we'll talk about how that's changing over time on a district-by-district basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom. I'll get the popcorn.
Okay.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, you said that when we switched from AFDC to free and reduced lunch, if we hadn't put that 0.6 factor in there, the distribution would have changed. So how would it have changed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, it's more the 80% and the way that concentration was designed than the 0.6. The 0.6 really just scaled the formula back so that we hit about roughly the same dollar amount that we were intending for AFDC-based revenue at the time. So it was really more the 80% on the concentration gave us a distribution that was more similar to the AFDC distribution by district.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom, yeah, so if you hadn't done that, would that have been more or less for Minneapolis and St. Paul?
Mr. Crow and Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, in part it would have depended on whether it had been site-based or not. The spread would have been greater, essentially, between the highs and the lows. And to the extent that there were some schools above that 80%, those schools would have gotten additional amounts of compensatory revenue. If the goal at the time had been to keep the dollars the same, then the 0.6 times the formula allowance would have needed to be scaled down a little as that level reached 0.8 if that had continued to go to 1. So you would have gotten a slightly different distribution. There weren't a whole lot of kids in schools above the 80%, so it wouldn't have been a big dollar amount, but the change probably would have pushed the 0.6 down to, I'm guessing here, but maybe 0.55 or 0.56 or somewhere around there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom, I'm trying to get, though, that did we help or hurt the core cities by doing that?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I'll have to go back and dig out the data on that. There were other changes going on at the same time, but my guess is that we kept things relatively the same. We were going into this a little blind because the change from AFDC to TANF at the federal level was really, really very, very swift. And the state legislature was not prepared for that change to come as quickly as it did. One of the big issues with the switch to free and reduced lunch as opposed to the AFDC is that's a count that student reported at the site. And so there were lots of concerns in the first year or two about how that reporting would work. There's significant underreporting, particularly at that time. There was significant underreporting at the secondary level as kids weren't interested in eating hot lunch in high school and so wouldn't report for eligibility purposes. So what we know now may have been different than what we knew then in terms of in terms of the relative amounts of participation. I should add that also school districts have made a much more aggressive effort over the last 10 years in getting students to fill out the eligibility forms, even if they're not interested in the meals. And that probably reflects a little bit on our statewide numbers as we look at the percent eligible for free and reduced lunch. But in general, it's my impression from the change that it was less about helping or hurting any particular group of districts than basically mimicking the distribution that we had prior for AFDC concentration. And, and not surprisingly, AFDC was much more concentrated in the center city areas than some other areas. Very little, relatively little use in the rural areas of AFDC at that time. So part of it distributionally, AFDC was sort of more heavily concentrated than free and reduced lunch is.
Representative Greiling.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Strom, I'm just, it seems to me by capping it like that, that would have hurt the core cities rather than...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, it's always in contrast to what, and if the number that was coming out was relatively the same as where the AFDC revenue was, it'd be hard to describe it as hurting them. You know, I think the issue is there's really no purity in the formula. There's some general principles. A free lunch eligible student has a higher chance of a more direct causation, perhaps with the, as our proxy variable, with a student in need compared to a reduced price lunch. But whether 1.0 and 0.5 are the right numbers there, or whether the concentration should have been as steep or as shallow as it is, also an issue. And I don't think that, I know there wasn't a lot of analysis of that because the change came fairly quickly.
Representative Greiling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it, I guess, because I think I'm not going to get quite my answer, but that maybe the answer is we don't know. But it just seems to me that the AFDC count was done by the county, and it wasn't as exact as the free and reduced lunch count. And so then by going to the more exact count, it sounds like we made an effort not to have any winners or losers and kind of get the numbers with these coefficients pulled out of the air to make it be about the same when we had an opportunity to get more accurate. And maybe nobody wanted to because there wasn't any extra money and they didn't want any winners and losers.
Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, I dug up one of the old printouts from back in the conversion days, and at that time, the current AFDC revenue for Minneapolis was right around $40 million, and after the conversion, in fiscal 96, they were at $37 million, and fiscal 97 at $41 million, fiscal 98 at $50 million. So the relative magnitude is pretty close to where they were. And I think that with the AFDC calculation, with the current compensatory formula, so I think, as Mr. Strom was noting, that those coefficients were all used to sort of keep the distribution of revenue pretty similar to what it was prior to the conversion.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just have to say that is why whenever you throw in, we all remember a former senator, or some of us remember former Senator Dougie Johnson, who just threw in coefficients until it benefited his area, But in this case, it sounds like they were thrown in to kind of keep things about the same. So I'm not disagreeing that it's about the same, but I'm just wondering, what if we hadn't tried to keep it the same? Then what would have happened going to free and reduced lunch? Maybe I'm not making my question clear, but that's my question, and I don't think I've got it answered yet.
Well, Madam Chair,
Mr.
Chair, Representative Greiling, let me give you a quick, what I hope is a quick answer on that. If you were to increase, as I said, the number of sites above 80 is relatively small, and we can very quickly here look at some current data and see if we were to uncap that, what the change would be. But essentially, I think your point is right. If that had been uncapped, if it had gone from 0.8 to 1, there would have been more money at some of those schools, and that's an absolute truism. And I guess the question and the reason I'm struggling a bit is the issue about what the right slope of that line is wasn't dictated by the public policy so much as it was dictated by hitting the line that where we were at before. So in my mind, it's less of an issue of what that slope is wasn't dictated by any research that said here's where we see a good relationship between free and reduced lunch and the proxy that we need for additional help. So that's my problem in answering the questions.
Representative Greiling. And the reason I'm poking at it so much is because it's still in there. That same coefficient is still there. And I just wonder what it does today then to if we had a different coefficient, if that one was just pulled out of the air.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, we'd be happy to put a quick printout together that shows you what that distribution looks like. As Mr. Crow was just pointing out on the graph, if you go back to that graph, what you do with the slope of that line is you'd make it less steep from 0 to 80 and then continue it up to 100. So
it would look kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. So you'd have again...
For those listening on tape, it's a slower line upward. Go ahead, Mr. Strom.
So Mr. Chair, you'd get a totally... Well, I shouldn't say totally, but you get a slightly different distribution all the way along that line. And there'd be less revenue for the middle part, and I believe, and we'll simulate this real quick here for you, that less revenue would actually cause a savings on the formula. So then to hit the same dollar target, we would have needed to up the percentage. And if my quick while I'm talking numbers are working out here, the same coefficients essentially would have taken you to about 0.72 instead of 0.6 of the formula allowance, and then the slope going to 100% instead of 80%, and distributionally then that would give Minneapolis an additional 1.7 million compared to the 50 some million that they're getting. So relatively speaking, about $50 more for a district like Minneapolis at the top end of that scale. I hate to use specific districts here, but for most of the districts in the state that are below the state average, at least they're going to get a slight reduction of about half that amount. So in the mid 20s for most districts. Although again, because of all sorts of interplay, another similarly situated school district like Brooklyn Center would get a $58 per student reduction on a formula change like that. So I'm not trying to be argumentative. It's just not clear to me that reducing the slope but extending it further mm-hmm. is better or worse, or was thought of as better or worse. It was really an issue that slope was chosen because it more closely approximated the current distribution.
And Mr. Strom, it's important that we note that the percentages we're dealing with now are vastly different than they were in the late 90s. So if the percentages over 80 back in the late 1990s are not what they are today.
Mr. Chair, that's right. And that if there aren't other questions, that'll bring us to the sure. spreadsheet that Representative Gaffney was asking about.
We'll continue. Representative Greiling, did you have any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Okay. Chair.
Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani, did you bring your pen today?
Actually, mine only said paper made on it.
Yeah, mine too.
What's up with that?
I don't know. What's the deal? We go to the bill signing today. We don't even get the custom pen. We just get this...
Bills.
Pen out of a box. What's the deal, man? Yeah. I know budget cuts are going on, but this is ridiculous. Representative Mariani.
Democrats are more frugal. We got the Cadillac from Bronte.
Yeah, okay. Right. Representative Mariani.
Although you can tell that the chair and I both look for the same thing almost immediately. So. Well, I won't belabor it. I mean, so I'm intrigued by this notion that, how you determine this formula, that there's a lot of weakness in looking at it from one, and looking at it from only one, I don't know how to say this, looking at it from only one characteristic of schools. So we just had a discussion about, so what happens if you go through the 80 to the 1, and the answer is, one of the answers is you're going to have less revenue for the middle part. Which means less revenue for, those middle schools, if you will, relative to poverty. And so there's a real symbiotic relationship that's happening here, up and down and all across the state, depending on what you do with the two extremes. And I would hope that we continue to struggle with making sure that there's a, an appropriate level of appropriations relative to the challenges that each school faces. But my question really is more a policy question. I let all these formula questions, come from my good friends, Representative Dabney and Representative Greiling and Representative Garofalo. But the issue on the concentration, and so I heard is that, there were kind of basic two two reasons why we did this. One, you know, this whole relationship with the county, you know, setting the, you know, not sure whether the county was setting the count right. But then also, you know, it's tied to this notion of getting resources, you know, to the school site itself. So when we did that, did we then develop, over and above the definition of at risk here, did we then develop prescriptive language on the use of compensatory dollars relative to concentration?
Got six people in the committee holding on their phones, and they're all saying it wasn't them. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, I think there's a couple of things here. The list in statute, as Mr. Crow said, in 126C15, lists the relative, the uses of compensatory money. It does not, and it did not ever tie that use to those particular students, but rather to essentially the list of activities that the legislature at that time thought were helpful in terms of addressing the additional need that students had. And so it's a relatively long list. There was some concern, again, as many of these lists go, there were individual school sites with particular programs that said, but our program is what we need to do, and whether that was reduced class size, saying we really need a small class size to do this, or a particular reading intervention program. Those things were all put on the list because individuals and their communities thought that those were the most important thing they could do in terms of increasing achievement. The school site movement was very strong in the mid-1990s, and the thought, part of this I think was driven by, as the charter schools were coming to the fore, but part of it also at that time, one of the large movements was that if sites were made if decisions were made by the school sites, we'd be in a better place. And so part of this was a deliberate attempt to give more authority to that site about how that money was spent and how much of that money had to go to each school site. There were lots of discussions in the late 90s and early 2000s about whether the district should have more say about that money or whether the site should, and whether the distribution should remain at the site or whether the district could have some flexibility in how that distribution went.
Representative Mariani.
So, Mr. Chair, so then over and above the allowable uses, if you will, in 126C15, we don't expect any kind accounting for distributions based on concentration.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, yeah, I think that would be accurate to say.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I pass. I think you've answered the question. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, just to clarify, because I want to make sure I understand this, could Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow go over the difference between a free student and a reduced student one more time? And maybe just also so that I have this, qualifying for free and reduced lunch determined how, and just a little bit of the history of that? I know it's fairly basic, but I just want to make sure I understand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, the nutritional programs for food nutrition services have been using free and reduced lunch status for years and years, and those are set by the federal government, and they key off the poverty level. And so the federal government sets the poverty level through a series of calculations, and that's adjusted by family size. So the poverty level may be at a certain level for a family of four, say the free lunch level is $28,000 for a family of four. If you're a family of six, that would be a higher number. And so the federal government has set the free and reduced lunch limits, keying off that poverty level by family size. So for the free lunch, it's set at 130% of the poverty level, and for reduced lunch eligibility, 185%. In terms of the person or that student qualifying for and generating the compensatory funding, they need to turn in the form at their school that they are required for the food service purposes. And that's what the school districts use. So the count is based on an October count of students, but throughout the fall from October through December, the school districts can send out the forms again and do other activities to encourage the students and their families to return those forms to the school, even if the children aren't going to be eating the free or reduced price meals through the cafeteria at the school.
Representative Bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there anything here that explained why a free student has double the cost then? If it's not, you know, it doesn't seem mathematically to work out in terms of the percentage of the poverty level. Or, yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills, that was part, in my estimation, the reason that free is at 1 and the reduced is at 0.5 is that's part of how the...
Network engineer in me says that. So that's an 802.11 problem. Probably 802.11a is what I think it is. I could be wrong, though. So if you've got data devices that are like iPads or wireless devices or phones that are periodically going out to the Internet automatically, that's probably what that signal is, because it was a cell phone signal that would always happen. That's just a guess. I mean, I don't know. You guys is wireless on for your laptops?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we've used our wire. We're continually connected through the wireless here.
Maybe it's not that, though. Yeah. So, that's the network engineer me talking. Sorry. So continue, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bills. So, in my estimation, the main issue of setting the free at 1 and the reduced price lunch at 0.5, there was some thought that the higher income level should have a slightly less amount, and it helped match the distribution of the AFDC funds. So, without that, you would have gotten if you were at 1 and 1, you would have gotten a different distribution. And that was part of the issue with the rather sudden conversion was to try and match that distribution.
Mr. Crow,
Mr. Chair, and Representative Bills, the other thing to think about in those terms is the kind of the magnitude of the number of students. As Mr. Strom mentioned, the reduced count is only about 25% of the free count. So, for fiscal 12, for example, the free lunch count is about 240,000, and the reduced lunch count is only about 70,000. And so little bit of a less of an impact with changing that half to something else, just because of the magnitude of free versus the reduced, just the proportion of the number of students that are free qualified versus reduced.
Representative Bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just in 126C15, then, are there any results or rubrics that were created or accountability measures in that as well? If I go there and read, would that be found there?
Mr. Crow, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bills, they're about... There's a reference under the use to saying it must be reserved and used to meet the needs of pupils who enroll underprepared and whose progress toward meeting state or local content or performance standard is below the level appropriate for learners of their age. So the targeting is based on something fairly concrete. And then there's this long list of possible uses because of those needs, and what it's kind of left to the site to decide which of those might best address the needs, and then there's a report required that basically says the district has to report the expenditures used to meet the needs of eligible learners, and then it says using valid and reliable data and measurement criteria, the report also must determine whether increased expenditures raise student achievement levels. So,
Representative Bills, did you have a follow up?
Hey, thank you. So it's pretty open then, mm-hmm. in terms of the results.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Representative Dietrich, then Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Bills, if you're looking for a list of those things that are eligible, they're in the gray book, which you probably have in your packet, and it's on page 19. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Strom, when we're talking about this compensatory formula, we're talking about a lot of different variables, and the one variable that hasn't been mentioned here today is school size. And when I thought it was about 5-6 years ago, there used to be a page in here totally on school size, giving the large school syndrome of what happens when you have schools of the size of 3,000 and a large number of compensatory, but not being able to get this formula to drive for you or to work to reflect the number of free or reduced students. Did I just imagine that, or was this that taken out? Or
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dietrich, in the Brown Book, there's just the two examples that kind of show a bigger school site and a smaller school site, and I think that's on page 14, but I don't think there's ever been anything in that book that goes extensively into the issue of large size and how that affects concentration. That and the point being that you can have a high number of students that qualify for free and reduced price lunches, but if you have a large building, that concentration percentage goes down, and you have a pretty significant reduction in the revenue per free and reduced price lunch student that's generated at that site, just because the concentration isn't there like it might be at a smaller building with those same number of students.
And there's also there's also an incentive for school districts to draw school district lines to cram all the poor kids into one school. There's also a financial incentive for that. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, the way the concentration works, if you were to have one school with 0% poverty and another with 80% poverty, you'd get twice as much compensatory revenue than if you had combined those into one large school with 40% poverty. I'm not sure I'd use the words incentive, but it certainly has that effect that the more your poverty is concentrated at particular sites, the higher your compensatory revenue is going to be. And Representative Dietrich, I think about either 4 or 6 years ago, when we spent a great deal of time in committee on compensatory, we had some pages that looked very much like that same typeface and same kind of examples to show what happened when you had a large building as opposed to two small buildings. And even if the boundaries essentially are not drawn so as to advantage the formula, if there's any disparate amounts of poverty in a district, if those disparate amounts are allowed to continue at two separate sites compared to one big site, you'll get more compensatory revenue. And we can dig those presentations out from about 6 years ago, but I think that's what you're thinking of. I don't think either the blue or the brown guidebook had that page in it, but it was in a very similar form.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I just, the whole formula being driven by the size of a school, and the amount of poverty in a school is very interesting to me, because then if you have high concentrations of poverty, you get substantially more money. That allows you to have more flexibility in your in the way that you spend your money and possibly go to smaller schools. And then those property poor schools who have been forced literally to build huge schools and draw from large geographical area, but high numbers of poverty, cannot get the equal amount of funding or even near. And you know, we'll talk about this more once we get to the runs. But the Anoka-Hennepin School District has the third largest count for free and reduced. We have, and we don't even get the state average. There are many other school districts that have less free and reduced count that get more money than we do. And at least in the way I see it, it basically comes down to your size of schools. How much property wealth do you have, and how many schools can you build and keep your schools small? And there are a lot of parents that think that that is an indicator of a high-quality education, which there are many parents in our school district that would love to have schools of 300 and 400. But we have discovered quite some time ago we can't afford to run schools that small. Our property base will just not support it. So you have kind of a dual thing working against you. You're property poor, and you have high numbers of free and reduced. And so this formula has always just dismayed me, and I find it very interesting to once again see an inequity based on just trying to get to a target and then feeling okay about the fact that some kids are worth this much money, some poor kids, and then some kids over here are not worth that much money.
Representative, oh, that just added an hour to the committee hearing. Representative Dabney.
Not quite sure how to take
it. No, I thought you were finishing up, and then I just looked over, and there's a bunch of other names added to it. So that was a good dialogue. So Representative Dabney.
I'm going to put staff on the spot here a bit, and it was Representative Bill's question about accountability measures in the compensatory statute that sparked this. And several times in committee this session, we've had similar questions about similar categorical funding aids. And I guess, since you guys are the ones who actually put all this stuff together, that you might be the ones to answer this. And isn't the kind of the philosophical, I'm using my hand, so I'm just like Representative Mariani, isn't the philosophical piece here that with the value of local control, that we say you get a dollar for this purpose, and a dollar for this purpose, and a dollar for this, and a dollar for this, and we're going to limit, we're going to put some limits on how you can spend those dollars, like we do on compensatory. But the accountability measure is not tied to each individual dollar, but is the final outcome of how your kid's doing on the state tests.
Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I think it's both that, and it methodologically, even if we knew what a good accountability measure were, knowing what dollars to measure with that would be exceedingly problematic in some ways. If you say at a school site that $4,000 is the regular money and $1,000 mm-hmm. is compensatory and $200 in special ed and another $100 in this pot, how do you attribute which portion of that funds, even if you've got them segregated so that you can tell what each of those is, how do you attribute each of those portions to the improvement in student performance? I think even if you could agree on a measure of student performance, I think that would be a very difficult task. Which is not to say that one shouldn't have accountability measures, but it's always the issue when you have a great big pot of undesignated money like the basic revenue, which is about 75% of the general education revenue, and then another pot, you know, we have another series of 10 things like operating capital and sparsity and compensatory. How would you determine which of those was the impact? Is it the district had sparsity money, so the compensatory wasn't really helping as much, or which order do you put them in is a very difficult task in my mind.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Devney.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as similar to if the kid does well in high school physics, do you give the credit to the physics teacher or to the first grade teacher who taught the kid how to read? And without the ability to read, they wouldn't have done anything in physics. So is it... Again, on a big philosophical basis, it's we're trying to figure out what the balance is between local flexibility, creativity, you know, within parameters and accountability and outcomes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that's certainly part of it. There are other parts of it as well, though. For example, in the 90s, as I was saying, site-based governance was all the rage, and there was a great deal of emphasis on regardless of sort of the educational outcomes, although that was certainly the theory behind it, there was a great deal of emphasis on saying we need more of that money to go to the site, and we need more site-based decisions about how that money is spent. That same level of argument isn't heard so much these days, but back when this formula was replacing the AFDC formula, that was a very common refrain pushed by many different kinds of groups about how schools should be reconstructed.
Thank you, Mr. Trump. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Before we go to Representative Erickson and Breinhardt, we do have some public testimony that wishes to be taken or given. Representative Erickson and Brinehart, is it okay if we take that public testimony now, or do you prefer to ask your questions now? Okay. So, members of the public, this is a public hearing, and we can take testimony at this time. And at this time, feel free to come forward and talk. And Mr. Strom, are the compensatory pilot grants included in our baseline revenue spreadsheets we were given?
Mr. Chair, no, they're not. There's a separate pot of money for a few school districts with that meet the large building criteria, essentially. In most cases, were originally referred to as the low-income concentration grants, and are now referred to as the compensatory pilot sites. The part of the rationale for creating that was that the idea that an alternative measure could come into play other than free and reduced lunch for purposes of determining the formula needs. But I think in large part as well that formula is the additional appropriation is a reflection that in certain circumstances like the large buildings the current formula is less than optimal for those districts.
And Mr. Strom, while we take testimony, can you maybe list for members? Prepare to give members a list of, unless you haven't memorized.
Mr. Crow's pulling that number up, okay. And it'll be up pretty quick here.
Okay, so thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Denny Carlson. I'm superintendent of the Anoka Hennepin School District. With me is Lori Resch, who's the director of elementary curriculum instruction and assessment. And if I could, I'd speak to both the compensatory formula and then briefly to the compensatory pilot. Just simply to say the compensatory formula does not work for us because of the concentration factor and the size of our schools. Representative Dietrich made that point earlier. We have several elementary schools with more than 1,000 students. We have middle schools near 2,000 and high schools near 3,000. Our poverty is spread out throughout our district. Comment on this, we don't build big schools because we think it is the best way to educate kids. It is what we can afford and what our citizens are willing to approve. We have each year in compensatory a cross-subsidy of about $6 million. That compares to our special ed cross-subsidy, which is about $28 million. But we are short $6 million each year for what we spend on compensatory programs, services, and interventions. We have 11,000, about 800, according to your data, students that are poor. That's about 1 in 3 in Anoka Hennepin that are either poor or free and reduced status. We have the third highest number of free students. We have the highest number of reduced students. Yet we receive about 1,200. That's above the regular student aid formula that you talked about. 1,200 for each poor student, while other districts get twice that amount for compensatory. And some, if you'll notice towards the end of the data run, charters get almost many charters get almost three times that amount. A family's zip code should not be the determining factor in supporting each poor student. Also, through the compensatory pilot legislation that we received some years ago, 2006 to be exact, we can focus on academic achievement in all schools, use data-driven best practices, and directly focus compensatory dollars where they are needed the most. Finally, I would simply say we very much appreciate that the legislature since 2006 has recognized the unfairness of the current formula towards Anoka Hennepin and serving our students, particularly our poor students. We hope you see that unfairness as well. With that, I would turn it over to Lori Resch with Mr. Chair, your approval, and she could speak to what we have learned through the compensatory pilot.
Hi, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair and committee members. We started this project in 2005-2006 school year and have continued it since that time. Initially, we began with three program goals. The first was that all students reach high standards and attain proficiency in reading and the areas of literacy. Second, that all students reach high standards and attain proficiency in mathematics. And third, that all teachers vary instruction in Muse assessment to guide instruction for diverse learners, thereby employing intervention methodologies that are appropriate for each individual learner to meet their academic need. We haven't yet met our goal of all students, but we are much closer than we were before. So what we did initially was we employed some teacher teams that meant we were able to reduce class size. We introduced interventions in math and in reading. And we also introduced protocols for instruction during the general education period of the day for all learners. We hired the Carey Institute, which is a Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement, to evaluate our program and guide us in our decision making. After the third year of the program, we realized that our teaming model, which helped us to reduce class size, when it was implemented with fidelity, we had fidelity measures for each of our aspects of the program, made a statistically significant difference in student achievement in a positive direction. However, when it was not implemented with fidelity, it decreased student performance. So after much discussion, it was determined that that portion of the pilot program would be discontinued because it had proven not to be as effective as we had intended. So we have, since that time, been using the compensatory dollars to fund our math recovery teachers, which provide support for math interventions in each of our elementary schools across the district, which means that we're able to deliver that just right instruction to a much larger number of our learners and have seen real positive gains from that. As a matter of fact, we have increased the number of students who either meet or exceed the expectations for third grade to be about 84.7%. We have a number in fourth grade of 79.7% and in fifth grade of 74.2%. So it's important to notice that during this time, both the standards and the assessments changed and became more rigorous and more difficult. And in spite of that, with the requirement on the fourth grade MCA 2 in mathematics of needing to grow over a year or improve over a year academically, we were still able to increase the percent of students proficient by 7.7%. Over the last 5 years, we have seen more students scoring, as I said, in the exceeds achievement level. We have 11.9% increase in grade 3, 10.6 increase in grade 4, and 11.5 increase in grade 5, which is a fairly significant increase in that high category. We've also seen our free and reduced students increase in their performance level by over 10% in the last 3 years. So we really do believe that this has had an impact on our mathematics instruction and made a difference in finding exactly those pieces of mathematics that children need to be intervened with and provide that just-in-time, just-right interventions throughout, across all of our schools and for all of our learners. So as Representative Dietrich mentioned, it's important that we consider that every child counts, no matter if there's 100 of them or 5 of them or however many there may be in a building, that each of those children get the services that they richly deserve.
Okay. Does that complete your testimony? Questions for our testifiers, Representative. First of all, before we go to Representative Peterson, what is your current? We can ask staff this. What are the current compensatory grants that are on a statewide basis? What are the districts, and how much do they get on a biennial basis?
Mr. Chair and members, there's about $2.2 million annually paid out in grant form for compensatory pilots. Anoka gets about two-thirds of that at $1.5 million. Osseo gets about $200,000. Robbinsdale and Rochester, $165,000 each. Brooklyn Center, $75,000. And South Washington,
$65,000. And how long has Anoka Hennepin been getting the pilot grant? Since what year? What was the first year you get it?
2005.
Okay.
2005-2006 school year, so fiscal year 2006.
Okay, you didn't get it before then?
No.
Oh, okay. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. We joke around a lot in Anoka Hennepin. I think you actually mentioned it last week when we got together. It's as if when it comes to some state education policy and funding that when they start to see Anoka Hennepin and the 42,000 students coming close to those metrics, that the line is kind of drawn right in front of that point where Anoka Hennepin would qualify. And I thought it was interesting, Mr. Strom actually kind of in reference to compensatory said that it wasn't really based in good public policy, but simply to match up with the benchmarks that had previously been made by the legislature. Kind of a point to throw out there, but I have a question. The pilot provides about $1.5 million in funding. You mentioned a $6 million cross-subsidy. Could you kind of speak to the programs that are or are not being provided as a result of the lack of that compensatory aid?
Mr. Carlson? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it is. It comes from the list that Mr. Strom and Crow read. I mean, it's interventions that we take out of our regular general fund. But I think what I would say is, I can tell you where the money comes from. It's more like where we don't spend the general fund money. We don't have a particularly strong, gifted, and talented program. The top 25% of our students don't have much. We have to concentrate it on other areas. In this case, it's all of interventions in both math and reading. We have some, paid for by the compensatory funding, a little bit by the grant, but we have simply many more needs than that. Almost having 12,000 kids in either free and reduced is a high bar to get over. If you look at our demographics of our district from the south, Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, we have poverty spreading north. I live in Blaine, Coon Rapids, and Blaine now you see, and in your area, you see the poverty moving north. With that come higher needs in all our schools. And I realize the compensatory formula is built on concentration, but I would say when those kids, whenever they hit our schools, whether there's 100 of them or 200 of them or whatever, they all have individual needs in those classrooms where they need additional help in math and reading. And we've been unable to give as much as we should in those areas. We know it's appropriate and to spend the general fund in that manner, but what happens is something else suffers. In our district, I think particularly that top 25% suffers. The other thing is Representative Dietrich said very well, we closed 8 schools and packed them in everywhere else. We can't afford to keep schools with low numbers open. And that goes to the overall funding of education by adding up all the formulas.
Representative Peterson, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, so how different are the poor kids you have in your Hennepin County area than the poor kids in the Anoka County area? I'm just kidding. You don't need to answer that. I just
thank you, Representative.
Okay. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good evening, Superintendent Carlson. We go back a few years, and I was real pleased to hear a couple years ago when Anoka tapped you to be their leader. And I guess this is a little bit of a rejoinder to Representative Peterson's observation or characterization of the testimony offered by Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow, I thought that what I heard in their presentation was that there was an effort. You know, we have history. We work off of history here. And, you know, so there was an effort to match up a new formula based off of an AFDC-based formula. And I don't fully get it, but I get the general gist of it in terms of what, you know, the intent there was. And it seems to me that, that bad public policy would be to do, in fact, what these good folks are telling us not to do. You know, what they basically testified with the pilot money program is that extra money counts. When you're educating, impoverished children, it sure does count. And I think back in 96, 97, what I heard was that folks were saying, yeah, extra money counts. And so it would be, in fact, bad public policy to produce an outcome that took away money simply because we're no longer using an AFDC-based program. And I'm just intrigued, Mr. Chair, that, you know, I understand there are legitimate, objective, analysis of what a formula does relative to any district. But I think it's important to have that conversation within the broader conversation that at the end, and I think this is partly what Representative Grayling was getting at, taking money away from schools is not a good idea. And so the challenge, of course, is how do we do that in an era where we don't have a whole lot of extra money, at least based on our current revenue scheme in the state. But I do have a very quick question. Relative Representative Dietrich mentioned that part of the upside of not running lots of schools, running big schools, I suppose there's ups and downs. But part of the upside is that there are some levels of efficiency relative to the total bottom line of the school district. And so I guess I'm wondering if you can share, I get the pedagogical application of extra, compensatory money, but what can you share relative to what costs would look like for your district if, in fact, you went toward a much more decentralized format of delivery with school districts, even with an adjustment of the compensatory money still make that an efficient delivery system for you?
Superintendent Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mariani, I'm not sure I can answer that. I mean, obviously there's some things. We have real good sports teams, given the size of our buildings. So we're playing Edina on Thursday in hockey.
Good luck.
Yeah, we're going to need it.
Yeah. I'm rooting for you.
Thanks. No. Rick Dressen is not. He emailed me that today. The piece that when you look at these formulas, it's hard to know exactly what we would do with a different formula. We get so used to operating efficiently in the district. I mean, we have under 3% administrative. We're very lean administrative. We're among the leanest in the state. We have counselors, one for 750 kids. And we've been roundly criticized for our response on bullying and suicide and so on. There are clearly areas that we would like more money. I mentioned, not lightly, that we have a $28 million cross-subsidy in special ed. We do all the things we're supposed to do with the money. But there are a lot of things we don't do. We could use much more student support services. We could do much more in academics. We have some things in the arts. We have very little in gifted and talented. There are areas we do not compete well. With St. Paul, Minneapolis, the western suburbs, we do not compete well in gifted and talented in some of the offerings. We just do not. And we cut fifth grade orchestra, I think, in the early 90s. I mean, there are things we just do not have. And I think, I would be remiss if I didn't say, come November, with a $48 million levy up for a vote, just a renewal, but if that fails, then we're in deep trouble. We already have class size. This would be another area that I think where compensatory could help immensely. Class size in the elementary level, 34, 35, 36. Middle school, school board, when Representative Dietrich was on the school board, put some extra resources at the middle level. At the high school, we'll have classes and core classes in the low 40s. So if the levy fails and we cut an additional 700 teachers, all those class sizes will jump by 10. And that's in the core areas. And that's then with virtually no local support, very, very little local support. Then we're entirely dependent on the state and their formulas to rescue us, and I frankly don't see it coming.
No, Mr. Chair, Superintendent, and I totally appreciate the sort of the foreboding about the levy, and ours will be up in St. Paul next year. And actually, when I first got here, we didn't have a levy. It was a big cultural change for our city to do that. I think it's appropriate for us to do that, but of course, we're expecting a lot out of our levies nowadays that we hadn't expected in the past. There is kind of a bigger challenge here for us, and I think that, and I know I'm editorializing, but I'll be very brief. I think the bigger challenge for us is one that really talks about a bigger context in terms of funding for our schools. And I would certainly hope that, I'm all for reform, But I would certainly hope that as we push reform that we don't leave behind the issue of the big question about whether or not, even in the macro, we're properly funding our schools. I think Superintendent Carlson and his colleague are making a good case for that point as well.
And it should be pointed out that Representative Bill still thinks that a levee is something you build along the river, just so you know.
We have one in my district.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on these grants that we're talking about, Mr. Schrammer, Mr. Crow.
Representative Woodard, hold on. Do you have a question for the testifier?
Well, I do, I think, because it's related to the question you were talking about with the grants. Is this a competitive grant that, that you're participating in, or how is that funded? How is that identified?
Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, it's not a competitive grant. The grantees are named in law when the appropriation is made.
Okay.
Representative Woodard.
Okay, thank you.
That was it?
That's it.
Representative Devney. I assume it's for the testifiers, because we still have Erickson and Breinert, but I'm assuming that when we go back to the starting line, we'll go to them. So Representative Dabney.
Yeah, if you're patient allowing me to build my base, I'll get to the testifiers.
I'll be a generous base, I'm assuming, Representative Dabney. Go ahead.
Thank you for the indulgence, Mr. Chair. No, something Superintendent Carlson said sparked a question in me, and it was your comment about watching the poverty move north and more into your district. And for your background, Superintendent, last week the chair took us on a tour, and one of the sites that we visited was the Hiawatha Leadership Academy, which is a high-performing, high-poverty charter school in South Minneapolis, just outside of my district. Largely students of color, I think it's 95% free and reduced. 91.2, I stand corrected. But doing very well. And I talked this over the weekend with one of the and the executive director, I think they call him, made a very strong pitch there for compensatory education funding, and particularly for the concentration factor because of the high concentration of poverty they have there and the shoe strength that they have to run it on. I ran this weekend into one of the founding boards of directors of Hiawatha Leadership Academy, a Latino man, businessman. And he was talking to me about what they're seeing in terms of the Latino population that's coming to that school. And what they're seeing is Spanish-speaking parents who are speaking, have a more limited English vocabulary than the Latino parents who were coming in there a few years ago. And he said, well, that was of concern, but when he realized that they also had a more limited Spanish vocabulary than the ones a few years ago, that was a greater concern because it's a bigger lift. The kid just has less experience with language and vocabulary in any language than the ones, let's say, 5 years ago. And so the work we're asking that school to do, or that the school is taking on, is harder. And I'm wondering, as you talk about poverty coming north, are you seeing, I guess at the kindergarten level, first grade, early years level, are you seeing differences in the population compared to a few years ago?
Superintendent Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Davini, yes. We're doubling both with students of color and poverty about every decade. Mm-hmm. Started when I came in the mid-80s, about 6%, then we're 12%, then we're 24%, now we're over 30%. We're now, I think, Lori, at about 60, 70 languages spoken in our schools. To your point, we would agree with that. The other thing that happens, and this is probably an argument for not taking money away from either St. Paul or Minneapolis, you know this, but poor families travel. Mm-hmm. So they will go from Minneapolis, St. Paul, to Robbinsdale, to Osseo, to Brooklyn Center, and to us. The more education they have when they come in, the better off we are. And what we're seeing from the immigrant population, some folks are coming not with a strong base of their home language. And that is something we're seeing more all the time. I don't know, Lori, you want to comment?
I'm also seeing a lot more students without school experience. Having never been in a school setting before makes a big difference about how they acclimate to that new learning environment. Mm-hmm. So we've seen exactly the kinds of things that you are addressing and speaking to.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Dietrich.
I forgot my question. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Reinhart, Peterson, then Ward. Representative Reinhart.
Is this for my general place on the list or my specific place in relation to this discussion?
Well,
I'm just going to cover I think it relates to both Representative Mariani's comment, Representative Dabney's, and the general consideration about the original foundation for considering concentration as a factor. And there have been several things said that I think are legitimate, but I think we failed to look in a comprehensive way at what concentration might indeed represent. Because, clearly any district that can get more money for, on an individual basis for students in need is going to be able to serve them better. And clearly it might be possible that the concentration formula could be viewed as a perverse incentive for maintaining certain boundaries, although I will say I served on a school board for 12 years, and a boundary change is almost equivalent to a cataclysm in a district, and you don't lightly take on a boundary change simply to get a better deal on a formula. So that's just a caveat to that. But I would say it seems clear to me that underlying a concentration formula are some sociological assumptions, which we've had no discussion or testimony to and would warrant some study in their own right. But that is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It's not just how many numbers you have of at-risk students, but it's the concentration in relation to the whole. There's something called critical mass. You get to a certain point, and it's not just about the individual needs of the students, but it's about what culture are you lacking in the body as a whole in terms of how students impact one another in terms of their need. And if you have a large concentration of poverty up to that 80 to 90% and above level, you've changed. It's a game changer in terms of what kind of community capacity you have to create your educational environment. And I'm not arguing for or against that, but I think that underlies something called a concentration factor. And I think it would behoove us to give respectful consideration to bodies of research that might address those factors.
Thank you, Representative Breiner. Well, Representative Erickson, I'm going to call on you because I've let people do it, and you've been patient. So I'm going to let you go, and then Peterson, then Ward. So Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was actually to Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, or for whomever. When a district or a site uses compensatory revenue and they have to submit the report, does the UFARS kick in? In other words, does the report indicate how many dollars they might have spent for remedial instruction in reading and math or other core areas or all-day kindergarten? Can you answer that for me, gentlemen?
Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, the statute actually references UFARS and the use of UFARS. It says each year a district that receives basic skills revenue, which is what compensatory mm-hmm. is a component of, must submit a report identifying the expenditures incurred to meet the needs of eligible learners. The report must conform to uniform financial and reporting standards established for this purpose. So,
thank you, Mr. Crow. So, wouldn't it be possible to track the results then, as long as the UFAR system is used? I mean, I'm curious. I mean, I'm hearing in this testimony, the good work that's occurred because of what they did. But would it be possible to determine a result from that report? I don't know if they could number the number of students, but
yeah,
Mr.
Chair, Representative Erickson, that certainly the district is keeping track of the results. The UFAR system is really a financial reporting system.
I know.
So we can see the expenditures, but at a mm-hmm. state level, we wouldn't really tie that back to a result per se from that report.
And Mr. Chair, that's always a question I have about compensatory revenue.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I'd add, I think the testifier from Anoka can tell you how they use that at their district, and most of the medium to large districts in the state will have that kind of analysis within their district for how those funds are used mm-hmm. as well. So there can be a very big distinction between a district knowing and analyzing its data as to how it spends money versus what gets reported to the state.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson?
No, that's it.
Thanks. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Reinert made actually some excellent points about taking a comprehensive look at all the factors that are related to the compensatory aid, and I think the point I was trying to make, and maybe didn't make it well, and Representative Dietrich also made, is that along with sociological and the critical mass type concept, is there are other things that contribute to it, like Representative Dietrich mentioned, the school size. If we had, for example, a small high school in South Coon Rapids that just served that community, I'm sure you would have a concentration factor that was vastly different than the one represented at Coon Rapids High School, and that I think that's a good conversation to have. And I think you know, maybe that's what our testifiers would kind of speak to as well, is that, you know, along with maybe considering some of those concepts, the other concepts maybe should also be considered. And I think that's the rationale, you know, behind the pilot and hopefully its continuation. I don't know if the testifiers want to speak to any of that at all. Don't have to, but that's all I have.
Superintendent Carlson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Wasn't me.
Oh. Something moving. I did want to comment on that. If, for example, our school we closed in Champlin Elementary, if that would become a charter school, where we're getting $1,000 roughly per student, I become a charter school and they peel off the kids of poverty from anywhere around there. When I look at your runs, you get $2,800 for each of the student coming there. That's the way I read this. And so to your point, I think it's well taken. To a previous point, we changed boundaries when we closed 8 schools to 3,100 students. That is not a popular move. And the other piece along with that, a University Elementary in Blaine, we risked creating a racially isolated school, so work with the State Department on that to not do that. We named it a specialty school, and there use integration funds to work in that direction. So you're right, all these funds kind of intertwine, but when you're looking at a basic funding formula that goes almost 3 times more when we're getting for a public school, if you want to do a charter school and go that route, Representative Peterson is exactly correct that that's the kind of unfairness you get from that.
Representative Peterson, follow up?
No, thank you.
Representative Ward.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to make just a couple statements about compensatory grants, and I'm going to use my hands talking to Bob. I'll probably talk in shorter sentences. So,
Representative Ward, I'm glad you said that because I couldn't even get away with that one. So, Representative Ward.
I'm and since Representative Anzalk isn't here, I want to kind of talk for him as well. You know, my friend from Roseau and Mankato and all of us that are kind of an outsider. It kind of struck me tonight with the compensatory grant program, and I didn't realize and recognize the fact that so many of the grants are, you know, in the metro and urban suburban area here. And Representative Grayling, I guess, you know, again, it leads to why the Minnesota Miracle is so darn important. And I know it's a high price tag thing, but I think that it just indicates again why it is so important that, and as somebody said earlier, no matter what your zip code is, we got to fund our children. We got to find sources of funding for our children and their education. And I think, and a couple of people have mentioned tonight the poverty is moving north. Well, in my district, poverty's there. It's north already. It's north already. And you know, we have a high concentration of free and reduced lunches, and Superintendent Carlson, I admire everything that you guys do, and that I think. I didn't hear it tonight yet, but Representative Dietrich, isn't Anoka Hennepin the largest school district?
Yes.
I missed it. I'm sorry, but you know, I think you're doing wonderful work, and for a lot of children. And you mentioned that you had to cut fifth grade orchestra. I heard that in your testimony. I thought, and we just started an orchestra program in Brainerd High School, and I'm not even sure Crosby High School has that. I mean, you know, again, I just wanted to say that, you know, as we go through this whole funding process, it doesn't matter where a child lives in the state of Minnesota, we need to start looking at more of an equitable, fair, consistent, sustainable funding process for all of our children in the state of Minnesota, period. And I just, you know, I just had to say that because I know Representative Anzelks would have probably said it as well, but, you know, I just wanted to say that, Mr. Chair, and thank you for allowing me to say that.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Is there any other questions for our testifiers? Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't really have a question, but as long as I heard New Minnesota Miracle, I had to speak up, and I will say that the Anoka-Hennepin School District, you know, they came here at one time when I was in the legislature saying the Core Cities has too much, we need some of that, and then they came and said, no, we don't want any of theirs, we want just money of ourselves, and then they got that. But, you know, they, to their great credit, and to Superintendent Carlson, when we came up with a plan that actually was fair to Anoka-Hennepin and to all the other school districts in the state, and including the core cities and the rural and the suburban, on a continuum based on need, they were, that was where we had our very first hearing that Representative Dietrich chaired, and the room was packed, and they were not a bunch of people that said, gimme, gimme, gimme. They were saying, let's treat us fairly, and we believe in treating all other kids fairly, too. Now when we get to the year 2011, and we're looking at a small pie, and we're looking at no new money, and we're looking at how can we take from others, and I don't hear them saying that, but I worry that that's where we'll end up here if we don't get to a higher plane. And yes, we don't have the money for that this year, but I think it would behoove us to look at fair formulas and phase it in as money is available, instead of short-term thinking, which is taking from some, and we certainly should be giving to all and not taking from some.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, hold on. Just wait. Representative Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was going to ask, has Governor Dayton talked to you about his commission that he supposedly organized to look at school funding?
Representative Erickson, he might have sent me a letter. I have not. Not that I recall. I do not, but it doesn't mean it didn't take place. I mean, my CLA is saying no, so I'll nod my head and say no.
Because, Mr. Chair, they had to have their work done by mid-March. I thought that's what he announced when he gave his seven-point plan.
Yeah, so, you know, Representative Erickson, I was not going to respond to my friend Representative Greiling on the Minnesota Miracle stuff, but now you've baited me into it, so good job. No, I mean, here's the reality, is that I wish we lived in a world where I could be the chair of this committee and I had piles of money to throw out in the school districts. Mm-hmm. I wish that world existed, and I wish I lived in it.
We don't.
Okay? I don't, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Governor Dayton put on the table a pretty, I think it's a fair characterization to say that it is an aggressive revenue-raising plan for the state, over $4 billion. And with $4 billion in additional revenue, he gave the education committee, or he proposed education funding of $28 million above forecast. That is with a $4 billion. Now, that does not measure, I don't think it's fair to say that that's a lack of commitment on Governor Dayton's part. It is an acknowledgement of the difficult times that we live in. And it is simply not as a matter of philosophy or ideology, but as a principle of mathematics. It is unrealistic to expect that we are going to be able to make the additional commitments that I know my friend wants to make and has proposed making. It is simply not mathematically possible, even with Governor Dayton's commitment to additional revenue. And I think that members of this committee know that. I think I hope most members of the public know that. But I just worry that when we reference that and we talk about it, that people actually think there's a chance that's going to happen, and it ain't. It's not going to happen. Not because of a lack of will or courage or conviction or principle. The numbers just aren't there.
And I wish I lived in a world where that didn't happen. But it doesn't. And this is just the beginning. But Representative Greiling, I feel like I kind of taken a swipe at you, so I think you got a fair chance to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad you saw that look in my eye that I did want to respond. Representative Garofalo and Representative Erickson, I don't think anyone here is saying that we have that kind of money this year. But I'm saying that while we don't have this kind of money, we should be planning for the future, looking towards having a fair system and working towards it and fighting for it. We should not be sitting here in 2011 and giving up on students in Minnesota and saying, I guess there's no way to balance the budget for education short of taking from some and giving to others so that we have a fair system. And it sounds like back in 1996, that's not what legislators did. They looked at what had been done before with AFDC, and then they tried to mimic it by coming up with the 0.6 that I was trying to figure out with my dialogue with Mr. Strom, if there's any rhyme or reason to that coefficient at this point. But when we did look at the New Minnesota Miracle, they did come up with, using the PS Minnesota report and their own coefficients or whatever they came up with a formula that was actually fair to all students all around the state. But you couldn't just take that piece and lift it out and not expect to have inequities if you only implemented a piecemeal education formula. So I'm just giving what would be ideal, but what we could also work towards if we put our minds to it. And I'm worried that this year, Mr. Chair, we're going to have, because we aren't willing to look long-term for our students, that we're going to have some rack and ruin on the short-term basis. And I think that will not be something any of us would be proud of doing. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you aren't going to take from some and give to others, and that I'm totally wrong about this, and I'll be the first to say it if I see your plan, and that is not what you have done. But I see we only have three ways to do it. One is to keep everything the way it is and protect education with no eye to the future, or there's a way to protect education and have a fair plan to be phased in as we have more money for education. And I always say that hopefully we're going to someday have more money for education. We've had flat funding since 1984, in essence. And then the third way is to be short-term thinkers and to say that, you know, looking at this formula, looking at whatever other formula, some have too much, and we don't have enough for them to have that much too much. So hence, we have to take it and redistribute it and somehow say that money doesn't matter for achievement gaps, and I think no one wants to argue that. So, and as far as your comments about the governor's task force and getting done on time, and we haven't had any big discussion of it, I'm not going to defend the governor on that. I'm as amazed as you are that it hasn't started yet.
Well, Representative Greiling, I didn't say anything about the task force. It was Representative Erickson. So she asked me a question and I answered it. So.
Representative Erickson, I'm just as amazed as you are that the governor hasn't started that.
I don't know if he has started it. I was just asking the chair.
Yeah.
He hasn't received any notification.
Hasn't been started.
Representative Greiling. So, I mean, Representative Greiling, I would just make three brief points. We can have the committee involved in this. But number one, it's important for members of the committee to understand the consequences of last session and the decision-making, the federal stabilization dollars, that even if somehow this committee shift-adjusted were able to spend more money than last session, if somehow we were able to make that happen, even by spending $100 million more than last session, we are still going to be below, from the school district's perspective, what they're expecting because of the federal stabilization money of $500 million. So the state's commitment, even if it goes up, is going to be $500 million lower because of the federal stabilization. So I can't control what Senator Franken does from D.C. From the state's perspective, that's an increase. But let me just make my three points, and I will give you a chance to respond. And second of all, as we talk about, you know, someday things are going to get better and we've got more money, and I do think the economy is turning around. There's no doubt about it. But we owe the school districts $2 billion right now. We're going to have to get $2 billion out of the hole just to get back to scratch in terms of a new formula or offering new money.
And then finally, I mean, I think it's fair to say that we shouldn't just take from one school district and give to another. I think that's fair. But I think it's also responsible that we take a look at programs that have a proven track record of not working and fund it, taking that money and reallocating it to programs that do have a track record of succeeding. I think that's a fair purview of this committee, and I don't think that this committee is talking about taking from A and giving to B. We're talking about taking from what is not working and giving to what is working. But go ahead, Representative Groen.
Well, Mr. Chair, if you want to take from what's not working and put it into what's working, of course, we could have many discussions about that. And I think if cases could be made, then we would all think that would be something we should do long term. But I'm just saying, if you're short term thinking, though, and you do things on a dime and you do it short term, then you are taking from some and giving to others for whatever good reason. As far as the $500 million stimulus money, I think that's a cheap shot to blame that on Senator Franken and the fact that we balanced our budget with cutting education, higher ed, and K-12, and backfilling with stimulus money. If you will recall, in the plan that we passed, that money was restored. It was not cut permanently. It was only cut for that one short while, and then it was put back again. So to make the argument that we're starting $500 million down, and that's how you're going to justify cutting education, I beg to differ with that line of reasoning. We'll have some very serious debates about that, because I think that would be a very disingenuous argument for you to make, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greiling, we don't budget on a fiscal year. We budget on a biennial basis. In the biennial basis last session, we reduced the state's commitment by $500 million. And now I'm supposed to come up with a way to pay for that. We don't budget on a fiscal year. We do it on a biennial basis. That is correct, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, of course. But then you also have to do, if you're going to do responsible budgets, which you've been trying to do around here since Governor Carlson's days, because we got into trouble only budgeting biennium to biennium. So we've been for quite a while budgeting on a four-year basis, and that money then, the $500 million, was restored in the budget that we passed. And so I hope you're not going to go back to just budgeting on a two-year basis and not looking at a four-year basis, because I've been around here long enough to know that we got in big trouble with that kind of thinking.
We should probably let other members of the committee get involved in this conversation, Representative Greiling. Any other comments from members of the committee?
Mr.
Representative Mariani.
Very quickly, so the chair shared that, and actually I think it's a good general desire that, you know, that this legislature should take from what's not working and put into what is working. I guess the question I have is, so what tools and what metrics are we going to be using to make that determination?
Representative Mariani, before we answer that question, thank you for your testimony today. You, you got a front row seat, so thank you for coming today. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify today on this issue? All right, seeing none, thank you all. And Representative Mariani, I did not, I was distracted. Can you repeat what you said?
No, it's quite all right, Mr. Chair, and I think it's a good objective question, and I'm actually really interested in it. What metrics do we have before us, or are we intending to use before us, to make the determination of if we're going to go down this road of taking from what's not working and putting into what is working? I'd be real excited in knowing what metrics those are. And so I guess, do we have those? Are we going to unfold those, or is that just sort of a general kind of value and desire on the part of the chair?
Representative Mariani, I think you bring up a good point, and I'm certainly not going to speak for the entire committee, but I think one of the things we can do is we can look back at principles. We can look back at first principles and values and say that those measures can improve student achievement. Things like parental choice, things like having parents more active and involved and having the opportunity to choose which school that their children attend. I think that's something we want to look at. We want to look at some of those schools out there that are spending less money than other schools, even though they have at-risk populations. What are the things they're doing? What are the measurements they're implementing? In addition, from a policy perspective, and this is related to financial policy, but in the area of financial policy, do we want to take a look at things that that are protecting the interests of the adults as opposed to the children? In terms of changing and redesigning this system so that instead of a focus on who has what or what we're taking care of for the adults, and we make these measures child-focused and achievement-focused. So that's probably about as specific as I'm going to get in answering your question right now, Representative Mariani, but I think it's I think those are some of the values and principles we're going to be looking at as a committee for those measures.
Well,
Representative Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would certainly join you in the exploration of those. I would certainly hope that those are, and I would certainly counsel that those are principles and guides that come in at the last minute, you know, imposed on a particular decision, but rather one that we can apply together as a committee and do so as objectively and as research-based and scientifically as possible.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Any member, other comments from members of the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Greiling, I admire you and respect the work that you've done over the years, but you talk about taking from some and giving to others. I would suggest that for too long we have been not giving to many schools and giving to schools, and being from a fairly small, I'll say a district that has not had a lot of political clout in the past, and I'm not saying that in a personal way, I'm saying it just in small rural schools in general, I think for too long we have not been given to, and I just want to make that little point. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, good conversation tonight. Thank you very much. I appreciate the hearing, and thank you to our testifiers as well as Mr. Strom and Mr. Crow. And members, you want to make sure you run before midnight because Mr. Crow turns into Cinderella. So with that, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Wouldn't that be a sight to see?